Welcome to the KUNM Call-In Show. I'm Megan Kamrick. In much of the country, cooler temperatures and changing leaves are the biggest signs autumn is approaching. In New Mexico, it's the scent of roasting green chiles at roadside stands and farmers markets and mounds of peppers and new red ristras. What does chile mean to you? Have you wondered what makes some chiles mild while others have your tongue dialing the fire department? And why are the spicy peppers so important to our state? On today's show, we dig into the world of chile, its history here in New Mexico, the varieties we cultivate here, and why it plays such an important economic and cultural role. Dave DeWitt is a food historian and one of the foremost authorities on peppers. He's nicknamed the Pope of Peppers. He has written numerous books, and his latest is The Field Guide to Peppers. Dave, thanks for joining us.
Pleased to be here.
Dave, what turned you into a chili head?
I came out to New Mexico in the summer of 1974. I had never been west. I grew up in the East Coast in Virginia. And this is where I experienced chili for the first time. And they were trying to burn out the gringo. And they tried, but they didn't succeed. And the green chili stew, they made extra hot to see if I could take it. And, of course, I was hiccuping. And I had actually had hair at that time. And I started sweating from the top of my head. But I just kept eating it. And that sort of hooked me on it because I'd never had any spicy food before. And it was part of the reason that I moved here in November of that same year without a job. I always knew I could get a radio job, though. So that would – and I did, but it didn't last very long. Then I opened a radio production company for commercials and so forth and started my freelance writing career. And I was writing about New Mexico food and travel, and you can't write about New Mexico food without writing about chili peppers. And then I realized that there wasn't very much information out there on chili peppers, and so I started collecting information, mostly from librarians across the state who had physical files that they let me photocopy and put in my own files. And all that material now resides at New Mexico State University Library, which I have endowed as the centerpiece for chili research and that sort of thing. And they have all my papers and books and that sort of thing. And so I don't know how many books I've written about chili peppers and spicy foods, but it's probably 20 or 25 at least. And I primarily write about them, but I'm running out of things to write about.
Really?
Yeah, well, I've written about the health benefits. I've written about every cuisine in the world that uses chilies. I've written the field guide to chilies. I've written the complete chili pepper book with Dr. Bosland.
I want to ask you about that because chilies are in cuisines around the world.
Oh, yeah.
And so many of those you've explored. What is it about the chili flavors in New Mexico that keeps you coming back to eat that, to write about it?
Well, we have a unique chili-based cuisine that includes the immature chilies, the green chilies, and the mature chilies, the red chilies. And so the state question being red or green comes up. And a high school student did a study on that. It's the first study that's ever been done. I published it on my Fiery Food Central site. And he found out that about 64% of the people prefer green chili to red chili. I prefer red chili to green chili because I think there's more depth of flavor there. But
you like the flavor of red better.
I do.
How would you? When people ask me that, so I say it's smokier versus green. What would you say?
I'd say it's a mature fruit rather than an immature fruit, and so it has more complex flavors and more developed and a little bit hotter usually because immature chilies are not quite as hot as mature chilies. And what happens is there's a dilution factor. The green chilies have so much water in them that it dilutes the amount of capsaicin that you're perceiving on your mouth and tongue.
That's the hot part.
Yeah, and when all that goes away and you have a dried red chili, it's going to be hotter than the green chili that preceded it.
Okay. I've usually, when people have asked me that from out of the state, I'm like, well, it depends. But okay, that's good to know. I always figured
This is all generally speaking. Right. Like you can say the smaller the chili, the hotter it is. And that's true for most chilies, except for the super hots.
The uber hots.
Yeah, they're something else.
Which that seems to be a race to make, like, find the hottest chili on the planet. Just
no,
blow
it's,
your
it's
head
a
off.
Race to breed the hottest
okay.
chili.
Okay, why? I mean, after a certain
because
point.
Because a person who gets the hottest chili and gets in the Guinness records, he can make a lot of money.
Yeah, but do you want to eat that?
No, it's mostly used to extract the capsaicin out of, to make oleoresin and so forth like that. Because the hotter the chili you start with, you know, it's easier it is. So if you take a jalapeno that's only about 3,000 or 4,000 Scoville heat units, you're going to have a whole lot of them to get the amount of oleo resin you need that comes out at 2 or 3 million Scoville heat units. But if you start with something that's a million instead of 2 or 3,000, yeah, obviously you'll need fewer peppers, and okay, it won't be as expensive to do. So the hotter the pepper, the better it is for industrial uses. And when I say industrial uses, they're making oleo resin capsicum so that when they manufacture, say, a hot and spicy potato chip, they know exactly how much to put on there. Hmm. And they can run it through a sprayer that will spray the exact amount of oleo resin, diluted oleo resin, and then they re-dry it. And so each chip will be exactly the same heat. And that's why they have this kind of technology.
Now, one of my many favorite episodes of The Simpsons had Homer he decided he had to try the Guatemalan insanity pepper, and it's so hot, he coated his mouth with candle wax so he could eat it. And then he has visions, and there's a Mayan pyramid. Anyway, kidding aside.
Well, they gave us the isotopes, so what are you going to say?
Yeah, I know.
Come on.
Kidding aside, though, chilies have been part of indigenous communities in North and South America for centuries. I read on your blog that archaeologists found chili plants in Mayan ruins in what is now El Salvador.
Right.
How did chili spread, and what role did they play in what's now New Mexico before and after the Spanish explorers and conquistadors?
Well, there weren't any chilies in New Mexico before
the Spanish.
There
were some, though, right?
No.
Oh, okay.
There were some wild chilies in Arizona and Texas, chili piquins in Texas.
Didn't they trade, though? They would have traded with southern Mexico.
We have no physical evidence that happened. I mean, no chili seed has ever been found in a prehistoric archaeological site in New Mexico.
But they were in Mayan sites.
They were.
I guess that's what I'm thinking of. Did we not have chilies up in North America in Plains tribes before?
No.
Okay.
Yeah.
So how did they spread? I mean, the explorers brought them.
Initially, the wild chilies were spread by birds.
Mm, okay.
Birds who are attracted to bright red fruits of all kinds. Pyracantha, for example, would be another example of a bright red fruit that a bird would eat. So the wild chilies were spread that way, and then chilies after that were spread by trading by human beings.
How were people using them? How are Native people using them in South America?
They were spicing up their chocolate drinks. We know that because that same archaeological dig in El Salvador, what happened was a volcano exploded. It was the equivalent of Pompeii, except all the people got out. And there weren't any bodies encased in the lava or the ash. But the ash coated this entire village. And so when Dr. Payson Sheets of University of Colorado excavated it, what they found was a field of chili plants. And in the storage areas, they would have these vases or vases, and some would hold chili seeds, and right next to them, cacao seeds. So we know that there was an association of chilies and cacao, and this goes back to the first explorers after Cortez, who reported these things, but nobody believed them. But now there's some physical evidence that, yes, chilies and chocolate were combined. So they weren't.
So that is not a new thing.
No.
At all, obviously.
No, it's not. And so now we know that some of the other tales of the chilies and the descriptions of the chilies that the first Spanish explorers found when they came to Mexico, they found what the equivalent of a chipotle is. They were smoking chilies, in other words. And so they described all these different chilies, and some of them fit the descriptions of the chilies we have today. So it's, you know, sort of fascinating. And then that's why I like food history so much, because you get into – it's multidisciplinary. You get into archaeology. You get into biology. You get into every other aspect of it, including medicine and those applications for chili peppers.
Yeah, because what were the medicinal properties of peppers people might have been using?
Well, they're an antioxidant, so they can cauterize wounds and that sort of thing, kill bacteria. And if you're going to eat say oysters on the half shell, sprinkle some hot sauce on them first, and it'll help with any bacteria that might still be around.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's good to know. I always feel like, oh, I like this oyster, but I'm taking my life in my hands.
Well,
okay,
good
to know.
The last oyster raw I ever ate was in New Mexico, and I got food poisoning from it, so I learned my lesson. And I'm not going to even try it with a hot sauce now.
Okay. Well,
cook your oysters.
So the Spanish brought the, as they came here, And they've incorporated it into the cuisine. Now it's become this huge part of New Mexico.
Well, yeah, they brought the seeds and they're
documented. And we created something. Can you talk about the land races? These are traditional plants that developed and adapted.
Chimayo being the perfect example of a land race chili, which is still being grown in this virtually the same fields for 400 years.
What does that mean? So make sure I describe that.
A land race is an indigenous crop. In other words, it's a variety that has been developed by farmers planting the same variety over and over and over again in the same fields for hundreds of years. And so it's not a variety that's been developed by scientists, by chili breeders like Dr. Bosland. It's something which occurred just by the farmers. And this was the original way. The farmers would take a particular pod that they liked, save the seeds, and plant it over and over and over again. And so it becomes a standardized variety. And that's what the chili breeders do, but they speed it up.
I'm going to come back to that in a minute.
Sure.
I just want to say this is the KUNM Call-In Show. We want to hear from you. What's your favorite thing about chili? What does it mean for you living or visiting New Mexico? How do you like to eat your chili? Join our conversation today by calling 277-5866. Outside of Albuquerque, you can call 866-899-5866 or tweet at KUNM News. We have Dave DeWitt here, nicknamed the Pope of Peppers, producer of the annual Fiery Foods and Barbecue Show. His latest book is A Field Guide to Peppers. So, Dave, you're talking about the land races and how those are created. So is there – these are sort of artisanal crops. Am I using the right word? Is it like a terroir? Not terroir, but what do they call it in wine? It has to be in a certain place. It's a Chimayo chili. So is it considered
of greater value, more flavorful? It's tied into a certain geographical area almost always. That's the way it has to be. And we have confusion with chili nomenclature.
Mm-hmm.
It's been just crazy because think about Anaheim chilies. I mean,
mm-hmm.
that's a confusing term that's rarely used anymore, but now it's a pod type of the New Mexican variety when originally all these long green chilies were called Anaheim. Why? Because a farmer moved from New Mexico to Anaheim, California, brought the chilies with him and developed fields of chilies there. And since it was close to Anaheim, that name stuck. And it's not an appropriate name. It's not a particularly significant name. There aren't any chilies grown in Anaheim anymore. But the name sort of stuck until Dr. Boslin and I took it upon ourselves to rename the pod type New Mexican rather than Anaheim and make Anaheim a variety within, like mm-hmm. Anaheim is just like a Big Jim or a New Mex 6-4 or something like that. It's just a type of a variety of chilies in a pod type that's a long green chili that turns red.
What's your favorite chili pepper?
What's my favorite?
Mm-hmm.
I like the Sandia variety.
Why?
It's hotter.
Okay.
And since I like red chilies more than green chilies, I would say that I probably eat more green chili than red chili, but I prefer red chili.
And Sandia, what does that indicate when you call it a Sandia variety?
It's a variety that's it's wider at the top than most chilies. It's a little bit shorter than most chilies, and it's significantly hotter than, say, a Big Jim or a New Mex 6-4 or something like that. And so it's the chili of choice for red chili, in my opinion.
And tell us what makes peppers hot. Why do the heat factors vary so widely? Is it based on size?
Well, chili peppers produce a chemical that no other plant or animal substance produces called capsaicin. And we believe that this was to prevent mammals from eating the pods and digesting the seeds. Birds can eat the pods, and the seeds pass right through the bird's digestive tract. That's how chili peppers were spread when they were little berries like the chiltepines. And so in order to prevent, say, mice and rabbits and so forth like that, and even deer from eating the chilies, nature developed capsaicin as a protective mechanism for them.
And that's what makes it really hot or not
yeah.
so hot.
And so depending on the amount that the chili makes, and remember I said the smaller the chili, the hotter, that's because there's not the same amount of capsaicin in a little tiny pod will be perceived as much hotter than if it's in a larger pod where it's diluted, like I was mentioning before. And the interesting thing that we've just learned, and it was announced by New Mexico State University, why the super hots are so hot. in, a New Mexico chili pepper, the capsaicin is in the placental tissue, the same tissue that holds the seeds. But in the super hots, it's all over the inside pod walls.
So if I take the seeds out, does that make the chili less hot if I'm making something? Or maybe not?
Not just the seeds. If you take all the placental tissue out that's associated with the seeds, it will diminish the heat in there. The fact that the placental tissue holds the capsaicin glands and holds the seeds gave rise to the illusion that the seeds are hot. The seeds in of themselves are not hot, but the capsaicin adheres to the seeds. In other words, coats the outside of the seeds rather than being on the inside of the seeds. And that happens during processing. So the super hots have capsaicin all over the inside pod walls, not just on the placental tissue. And that's why they're so hot. And that came from a freak of nature that happened in Trinidad prior to 1846. We know these things from food history.
And so for pepper wimps like me, what do you suggest we have on hand if we get a hot one? It feels like our mouth burning will never end.
The thickest dairy product you can find.
Okay.
I would say
ice cream, yogurt.
Sour cream.
Oh, okay.
Yogurt works fine. Ice cream works. Milk is no good. I mean,
Work
a little bit. But
okay.
If you're going to try 2% milk, what does that tell you? It has 2% butterfat, and that's it. And so that means it's 98% water, essentially. And water does not mix with capsaicin, so it's not going to help you. It gives you the illusion of cooling off, but the heat comes back.
So beer and bread's not going to...
No, but if you drink enough beer, then you won't get, you know, much...
you won't feel the pain.
You won't perceive the heat as much.
Well, we have this explosion in foods that combine with peppers, ice cream, beer, bacon. I just went to a class. We made paletas at Pop Fizz with peach and candied green chili. Are these just fads, or is it just people really getting into chili?
I think it's just... part of the whole culture of chili peppers that people will experiment with them and put them in just about anything you can imagine. I mean, Pertsavka vodka has been around for, 50 years or something? A hot and spicy vodka. So this is really nothing new. It's just a easy way to make a Bloody Mary, I guess.
Well, this is the KUNM call-in show. We're going to take a quick break. We're talking about chili in New Mexico. We'll be right back.
Support comes from UNM Foundation, helping generous donors support student scholarship, patient care, research, and much more through the many programs of UNM. Learn more at unmfund.org.
Support comes from the University of New Mexico Comprehensive Cancer Center, where board-certified oncology physicians and dedicated cancer researchers provide cutting-edge cancer care. More information at hospitals.unm.edu.
This Saturday, starting at 9 a.m. on KUNM, the Children's Hour will have a live performance by the Gallup, New Mexico band Rippy and the Sillyettes. Featuring two young girls and their dad singing about real life events, these kids will blow your minds. With a family events calendar, the KUNM Kids Birthday Club, great music for kids and by kids, the Children's Hour, Saturdays, 9 to 10 a.m. right here on KUNM.
This is the KUNM Call-In Show. I'm Megan Kamrick. We're talking about chili peppers. It's an important crop in New Mexico, both economically and culturally. Are you a chili farmer? Do you grow plants in your backyard? What challenges are you facing as you grow this iconic crop? What do you think we should be focusing on to ensure chili remains part of New Mexico's economy and culture? Call now, 277-5866, or toll-free, 1-877-899-5866, or email callinshow@kunm.org. We have Matt from Rio Rancho on the line. He wanted to talk about some peppers that he saw in Korea. Matt, are you there?
I am.
So what did you want to ask about?
Well, so I grew up in northern New Mexico, and I went into the service, and my first duty station was in Korea, and they had this chili pepper that was so similar to chili piquin. They would dry them out on the sidewalks, and you'd see them lying out there and dry them just the same way that you see them here. They would even have things similar to ristras, but they were much smaller. But I was curious, is that pepper similar? Is it the same? I guess it is similar, but boy, it was hot. It made me laugh when you guys were talking about the beer, because that's the way we always found to take the heat away, was to just drink copious amounts of alcohol. Well, but that pepper would get you, and it was so similar to poutine. I'd tell my father, I'd call him, I'd be like, man, they got a pepper here. I think it's better, and he'd get so upset.
Oh, so Dave, did that chili migrate over to Asia?
Well,
from
chilies were spread by the Portuguese explorers and the Spanish explorers. And so after Columbus, within 100 years, chilies had spread around the world from these explorers because people found, oh, my gosh, there's something we can actually grow that replaces black pepper, which was so expensive and imported from India most of the time or Indonesia at that particular time. And the Koreans have the highest per capita consumption of chili peppers in the world. And so they like it, especially with their kimchi, the fermented cabbage and onions and so forth that they make. And it takes a lot of chili peppers to do that. And so, yes, these are probably a type of cayenne that has been developed locally in Korea, specifically for the Korean chili markets. And there's a lot of Asian hot sauces out there. I remember going to a supermarket in Malaysia. And they had three aisles of nothing but hot sauces.
Wow.
Three aisles.
That's a dedication to hot
sauce.
Yes.
So, I mean, that's why they have the highest
Isn't it interesting, though? So those weren't there before exploration of the New World, quote unquote.
Well, no.
It's all evolved since
no,
then.
No. Just like tomatoes and potatoes, chili peppers are a New World crop and were spread into the Old World and discovered anew just, you know, as potatoes became famous, and it took tomatoes 100 years to break through in Italy before anybody would eat them.
So do you think this was a pepper similar when he's saying it's similar to what he saw here, and that's not too far off?
Oh, no, it's not too far off at all.
Okay. Do you have a question about chili pepper? We've got the Pope of Peppers here, a few other guests coming up. What questions do you have about chili? What would you like to know? How do you like to eat your chili? Call 277-5866 or tweet us at KUNM News. You can also email callinshow@KUNM.org. We have Clifton from Albuquerque. It sounds like you're growing some chili, Clifton.
Yes, we grow chili here in the North Valley. I'm always a little astounded that Hatch has such a reputation, and I wanted to ask Dave. It seems like what they do is grow more chili than anybody else. We grow Big Jims and Sandias and Española improved here in town, and we roast and sell a lot of green chili. And one of the things we do in the fall is take the red chili, and rather than dry it, we make fresh red sauce, which I understand is a pretty popular thing to do down south. So I have two questions. Does Dave have ideas of where and why the fresh red sauce is made? And also this question about, the relative merits of Hatch versus Lemitar, Velarde, and other chilies grown around the state.
Okay. In the first place, the fresh red chili sauce is wonderful.
I made it the first time I ever made it.
I tasted it and sat down and ate a whole bowl of it as a soup. It was so delicious. And so I completely agree with you that that's one of the peak of chili flavors. What I'm going to say next has gotten me in an enormous amount of trouble, but there is no such thing as a Hatch chili.
Okay. Well, okay. Why is that?
Because Hatch has become a marketing term that replaces the term New Mexico chilies.
Okay.
So when somebody says we have Hatch chilies, that means a chili grown in New Mexico. And the little town of Hatch was originally called Hatch's Station. And this was in 1881. And it didn't have any chilies being grown there at that time. It was just a railroad crossing. And so when the chilies...
So that's not like Chimayo where it's been grown for centuries.
Okay. Right. So... The term Hatch was referred to Colonel Edward T. Hatch, who was the commandant of the 9th Cavalry in New Mexico, and he was awarded a little town named after him for his service, in the Army in New Mexico. And it had nothing to do with chili peppers. And so because of the Hatch Chili Festival, which has been going on about as long as my Fiery Food Show, about almost 30 years, the name Hatch and chilies got associated together. And then when the New Mexico Department of Agriculture started promoting the roasting and peeling of green chilies in other places, like in Austin and Dallas and Fort Worth and Houston and in Arizona and even Kansas. This is turning into a late summer tradition to roast and peel the chilies. And so they were promoting hatch chilies. And so all of this has turned the word hatch into becoming a marketing term for New Mexico chilies.
Well, there is a contentious lawsuit going on right now about that we won't delve into. You can find out more on our website, KUNM.org. I'm glad we had someone who grows chili coming on the line because we also have in the studio John Sickler with Sickler Farms. His family has been farming in the Rio Grande Valley for six generations. John, we'll have the Chili Association on in just a bit, New Mexico Chili Association. According to their website, around 8,600 acres of chile were harvested in 2013. That's just a fraction of the more than 34,000 acres that were harvested in the state in 1992. So what's going on? Should we be worried about our chile? Is it endangered?
First, I'd like to say I'm not doing the farming right now. I have in the past. I work with my dad.
Mm-hmm. You have cousins doing it.
I have cousins doing it. They're growing chile for us. My wife and I have had a store in San Mateo, a little bit south of Lomas, for the last 30 years. I haven't really been in the farming business myself, but I've obviously been associated with it. There's just a lot of factors that are going on today. One of the biggest things is the competition. There is more chili being grown. More chili being eaten, I would say, or more chili being consumed in New Mexico and around the world than ever before. But there are other places that can do it a little bit more cheaply or a lot more cheaply. And there's a lot of imports that are coming in from other places, Mexico, Peru, China even. So it's not as equitable, I guess. It's not as profitable for chili farmers in New Mexico to grow it. It's an expensive endeavor, and it's a challenging endeavor. And so a combination of those things mm-hmm. has caused the production to go down. But as my colleagues, Dave DeWitt and others, have said, that the yields have gone up too. So even though we're growing less, we're growing more with less acreage.
We've had a lot of stories in the last few years about the labor shortages to pick chile. Because it has a fairly long growing season, or it comes at different times. So we keep hearing we'll get a mechanized picking machine someday that people keep working on. Is that going to happen?
Almost all the red chili now is mechanically harvested.
Right, but the green chilies.
No, because the green chili develops over time. And so say the green chili season extends from the latter part of July all the way through September. You have green chili planted at different times, and it just keeps putting on pods, and the pods keep coming on. And as if you keep picking them, they'll produce even more pods until the first frost. And so you need to have human beings in the field, because the mechanical harvesters tend to grab the whole plant.
Mm.
And so when all the pods are dried and red on the plant, a mechanical harvester can take that and separate the pods from the rest of the plant. But you can't do that with green chilies. And so far, they have not invented a machine that can successfully harvest green chili and get all the pods sequentially, I guess you'd say, because it hurts the plant too much.
So, John, do you face this every year? Do you have problems finding people to bring the harvest in so you can sell it at your stand? Or your cousins, I guess.
Sure. Yeah, because not really. I mean, we have not had that problem. My cousins have been able to maintain a current flow of folks mm-hmm. working, and the older ones getting replaced by some of the younger ones. I can envision a day when that's going to be more and more problematic, for us personally. I can also imagine that it has to be a problem for other farmers
mm-hmm.
Because it's just hard backbreaking work, and fewer people are going to want to do that in the future.
We have an email from Dave. He says putting salt on your tongue can help erase the heat from a chile. Is that true?
They say that drinking hot tea will help. They say eating sugar will help. Dairy products are the answer.
Okay. But apparently Dave has found relief. And another comment from Damien. He wants to hear more about Chipotle-style chiles and wants to remind people that Chipotle isn't a variety but rather a way of preparing chili.
Yeah, it's okay. it's just a smoked chili.
Oh, okay.
And,
I did not know that.
Chipotles have been around for millennia. In the United States and in Mexico, it's the red jalapeno that is smoked. And right now, what the plants do is they dehydrate them first and then smoke them.
We also have a call from Jenny in Albuquerque, and she wants to ask about stuffed chiles. Oh, Jenny, we lost her. Okay.
Chiles rellenos is what she's talking about.
Yes.
And the long red chiles and the poblano chiles can be stuffed with any kind of a variety of things. Mostly cheese is used, but there can be stuffed with meats, combinations of meats and cheeses. Just about anything you can think of can be stuffed inside a chili.
This show's making me hungry. I've been up since 4 o'clock. We are on the KUNM call-in show. I'm Megan Kamrick, and it's chili harvesting season, and chili's our focus today. What it means for us as a state, for our culture and our economy, and our taste buds. Are you concerned about the future of chili in the state? Why do you think it's so important? What should we do to ensure we can keep producing this iconic crop? Call 277-5866. Outside of Albuquerque, 866-899-5866. Or email callinshow@kunm.org. And we've been talking with his food historian and pepperhead, Dave DeWitt, as well as former chili farmer, John Sickler. He sells at his farm stand. His family still farms chili in the Rio Grande Valley. We're joined now by phone by Michelle Miller. She's CEO with the New Mexico Chili Association. Michelle, are you there?
I'm here. Hi, Megan.
Thanks for joining us this morning. So we have seen a number of efforts to protect and promote New Mexico chili over the years. Dave mentioned the Hatch controversy. There's an ongoing lawsuit about that and how products should be labeled if they claim to have chilies grown in Hatch. We're not really going to delve into that lawsuit here. Listeners can read more about that at our website. But one thing that some producers are seeking in that case is a certification mark so consumers can identify the source of the chili in a product. Now, the state does have a certification program in place for chili grown in New Mexico. How does that work? Who participates?
Well, as you know, as you guys have been talking about, New Mexicans and really consumers around the world love New Mexico chili. But most people believe that, you know, the chili they consume is grown in New Mexico, but a great amount of it is not. And so what we have been seeing is producers outside of New Mexico trying to capitalize on the New Mexico reputation and slap that mark or that reputation on their own product as if it was grown in New Mexico. And so the New Mexico Chili Association has taken an attempt to reverse this and developed its own certification program that verifies that if a product is claimed to be certified New Mexico chili, it indeed is, and it can be proven and verified and guaranteed that it's grown here in New Mexico. That's what mm-hmm. the New Mexico Certified Chili Program is about.
And so if you're a grower, you apply for a certification so you can say?
That's right.
Okay. And mm-hmm. so how does that mm-hmm. work? You apply to the state?
No, well, you apply through the New Mexico Chili Certification Program, and that is a program that is overseen and managed by the New Mexico Chili Association more broadly. So it's a program that we manage, and we do it in partnership with the New Mexico Department of Agriculture. But our program coordinator actually goes out into the field and verifies the source of the chili that they are hoping to be certified. So it's a great program, and it allows for consumers to be sure that the chili that they're buying and consuming is indeed New Mexico-grown chili.
And do they have to pay an annual fee or a one-time fee to get that certification?
Well, there's different levels to it. Processing companies and those that pack and sell fresh produce pay the fee, but it's free for farmers markets, small local farmers, restaurants, grocery stores, et cetera. So there's different types of levels of application to it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if people are interested in learning about how to become certified, I can direct them to that.
So if you're a large-scale farmer, you pay, what is it, like $500 a year, I think? Is that what I saw, too?
It's based on the pound. Yeah, on the
John, has volume. Has your company done this, John? Or the folks who are farming the chilies for you?
Yeah, my cousins that are farming chili. I honestly don't know. I mean, our customers, because we've been growing chili in the middle of Rio Grande Valley for like six generations or somewhere on that order, our customers just know that this is local New Mexico chili. I don't know if my Chris or Craig or Scott or any of my cousins that are growing chili have gone through that process. Honestly, just don't know.
So, Michelle, what's your impression as the program's rolled out the last couple of years? What's the participation's been like and how it might be impacting some of these problems that farmers and producers are facing? What's your sense of that?
Well, I think it is, it's been in place for a couple of years, and so it is growing. It's becoming more recognized. If you drive through a McDonald's drive-through, chances are you'll see the certified chili, New Mexico certified chili logos sticker on the drive-through window. So it's becoming more and more common, and people are recognizing that it is there. And so that in turn causes people to ask for it. And so it is that process of rolling out the program, having it become established, having consumers ask for that or demand that their chili comes from New Mexico, and it's proven that it's coming from New Mexico through, you know, their source, their restaurant, their grocery store, what have you.
And is it different from the Chili Advertising Act? Is it work in tandem with that?
Well, it works in tandem, but those are two different things.
Okay.
The New Mexico Chili Advertising Act is a law that the New Mexico state legislature put in place. The New Mexico Chili Certified Program is a voluntary program, as I said, sort of, you know, that allows processors and growers and farmers to go through our process that gives certainty to consumers that the chili is grown in New Mexico.
So the Advertising Act is the one that has penalties. If you say that you've got New Mexico chili and it finds that you don't, you could be penalized for that. Am I
right?
That's right.
Okay. It only applies to chili sold in New Mexico, whereas the chili certified program it is applied all over the nation. It applies to chili sold all over the nation. So that if you're in New York City, someone told me the other day, you know, that they went into a grocery store in New York City and they found chili that had the mark on it. So someone was processing chili and has been accepted, and they're, you know, that chili is being sold throughout the country, and the consumer can know in New York City that chili was grown here in New Mexico.
Okay.
And that matters to a great deal of people. And it really does matter to the industry in New Mexico. So it's important that we continue to validate and verify this to try to offset the competitive pressures that are ongoing. And that is why the program was developed.
Okay. Well, thank you, Michelle Miller from the New Mexico Chili Association, for joining us this morning. I appreciate that.
Thank you, Megan.
This is the KUNM Call-In Show. Where do you get your chili? Is it important for you to know your grower, know where it's coming from? Can you taste the difference in your chili? Call 277-5866 or tweet at KUNM News. We will be right back.
KUNM presents a cool limited edition 50th anniversary t-shirt in sizes small to extra, extra large. Watch your mail for a letter from us that includes a picture of the t-shirt. Reserve yours with a gift of $10 a month. We will only order the actual number of special 50th anniversary shirts that you reserve. So be sure to return your card or go to KUNM.org. Ordering the limited edition t-shirt also automatically enters you to win a Volvo XC90. Details at KUNM.org.
Native elders deserve our respect. It's also a part of our traditions. But how far does that respect go when work pressures, children, and our own financial situations challenge the way we care for the elders in our family? Are we taking care of our elders properly in Native America? Join us for this discussion on the next Native America Calling.
Weekday mornings at 11 on KUNM.
This is the KUNM Call-In Show. I'm Megan Kamrick. We're talking about Chile. We just heard from Michelle Miller from the New Mexico Chile Association about the certification program. We're joined by Isara Andaluz. She's with the Save New Mexico Seeds Coalition. Isara, the idea of helping people buy authentic New Mexico Chile sounds like a really good idea, but your group has some concerns about this. Can you talk about that?
Yes, and actually, after listening to Michelle speak right now, I'm a little bit concerned about this thing that it's free for the small farmers and farmers markets, because that's not the case at all. First of all, it's not a state program. It's a program of the New Mexico Chile Association. They do work closely with the state and New Mexico Department of Ag, but it's not a state program. And it's open to their members. So you have to pay a $500 fee to get the certification mark. And she mentioned the New Mexico Chile Advertising Act, which is, like she said, it is only applicable here in New Mexico. So what happened was the Chile Association passed a law where we in New Mexico couldn't call our Chile New Mexico unless we registered with the Department of Agriculture. And then they came back the next year and said, oh, you can't call it by any geographic name, which is all the land races. So even if my Chile is called...
You mean the legislature passed the law,
yeah,
not the association.
Yeah,
okay.
But the Chile Association introduced the
Oh, they
the
helped, law. They lobbied for it.
They introduced it and they got lobbied for it and they got it passed. And that was crazy because it's like, so I cannot describe my chili as Isleta or Chimayo or whatever, even though that's the varietal name of the chili, which is ridiculous. And we couldn't get the legislatures to understand that. So then they had a hearing. And so we went to the hearing. I said, okay, so if I take Isleta chili and plant it in the South Valley and I do not register with the Department of Agriculture, I can't call it Isleta and I can't call it South Valley. They said, yeah. Okay, so if I grow Isleta chili in the South Valley and I register with the Department of Agriculture, can I call it Hatch? And they said, yes. So then what happened, the next thing we know is here's this certification mark, you know, New Mexico chili grown. The problem is that under the state law, you can put 5% of any other kind of chili added into your chili and call it New Mexico. And this certification mark that the Chile Association has for the national stuff is it can only have like a little percentage of chili and they're still calling it New Mexico. It applies to every single type of pepper. It can be a bell pepper, a jalapeno, serrano. So it's just not just the New Mexico chili that everyone thinks, you know, or like the Hatch chili they call it. It applies to every single type of pepper.
One thing that your organization has said is that this idea, the certification, is an attempt to take control of local chili growers by sort of commodifying a staple food crop. What do you mean by that?
Because what happened was we found out that the New Mexico Chili Association was having a genetic engineered chili developed for them. And so we started doing tastings of our nativo chilies. And when we did the tastings, we compared it against some of these chilies from the southern part of the state. And the nativo chili always won. And there's been more and more people growing the chili and selling it at the markets. So it's competing with some of the local chili people down south. So that's when these laws got introduced. And the thing is that when you want to get the certification mark for New Mexico certified, you have to tell, and also for the state law, you have to tell NMDA where your fields are planted, what you're planting, who your customers are. I mean, that's very invasive. So it's all about control and taking away our ability to call our chilies by their true names.
We actually have a question from Pat that goes to this. Does mass production of chili change the flavor of peppers over time? That might be a good question for you, Dave.
A lot of people claim it does, and that's why New Mexico State University has come out with what's called improved varieties or heritage varieties, they call them. And Paul Boslem went back to the original seeds for the 6-4 that were cryogenically stored in Colorado and did a whole breeding program to reestablish the 6-4 with its – yeah, theoretically, it's better qualities, which were lost during the massive growing of this. I don't know whether that's true or not, but it's a theory. And the farmers seem to like the Heritage 6-4 better than the other 6-4. Now it's taken over as the primary chili variety that's grown in New Mexico. I will point out that the New Mexico legislature in the 70s was the one who came up with our two state vegetables, neither one of which is a vegetable. chili peppers are not a vegetable. Chili peppers are a fruit. Mm-hmm. And pinto beans are not a vegetable. They're a legume. Those are our two state vegetables, neither one of which is a vegetable.
Are you saying they're confused sometimes about agricultural issues?
it's just amazing when you turn over the regulation of horticultural things to a legislative group mm-hmm. who know nothing about it.
We have a question that might go to some of your concerns and some of those issues from Placidas. Nick has a question about chiles and GMO. Nick, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
What was your question or your comment?
Well, I mean, I've been consuming chili my whole life, and I'm not going to stop anytime soon. But I was interested to know if your panelists know, you know, what genetic modifications have been made to chili over the years. Is it still pretty much, you know, like a heritage crop, like we want to believe that it is?
What kind of odd type of genes
might have been interspersed into our chili so that we can know? I just would like to know those kinds of things.
Okay. All the chili that's grown in New Mexico has been bred by traditional process. There have been no gene transplants or anything like that.
NMSU working on some things like that? No? Am I wrong? Okay.
No, they are.
Everybody says they are, but they say they're not.
Well, I've already spoken to them, and we actually had a hearing, and NMSU said that they would own the patent on it. And what they're trying to do is they're trying to develop a chili that's resistant to Phytophthora and Roundup. So they are working on a genetic engineered chili.
Okay.
Well, but they're using traditional methods, they say. There's no such thing as a GMO chili right now.
Mm-hmm.
No GMO chilies exist. There was a GMO tomato. And what happened to the GMO tomato that everybody was so worried about? It failed miserably in the marketplace because it didn't taste very good.
And so we can hope for that.
So, you know, the tales about GMO crops, 80% of the corn grown in this country, 80% of the corn that we eat is GMO corn. I ate some last night. It was delicious. I'm still here talking to you about it. I didn't get stricken dead by a GMO crop. And so there are GMO crops out there that we eat all day long. And we don't even know it.
I anticipate that we'll have a lot of callers who want to talk about this. We'll say we can't really delve into that. That's a huge issue.
Right, it is.
But I know you are concerned. Go ahead, Osar.
No, I want to say, first of all, GMOs, everyone uses the term GMO and then genetic engineered, but it's really genetically engineered. Because all the chilies in New Mexico, when you plant a plant and I plant a plant and they cross, that's genetically modified. But there's no gene transfer.
Right.
So what's happened now is NMSU is using a technique called cisgenic, and that's where they're saying it's not genetic engineering, but it is genetic engineering.
Okay.
And the problem is that, you know, that's the way we try and pass the Farmer Protection Act, that, you know, if you want to do genetic engineered chili, fine. But you know what? You need to make it sterile so that it doesn't cross over to the native chilies. Because the native chilies, like you were saying, and we all know, they've been planted for hundreds and hundreds of years. They've acclimated to the areas here. The taste is phenomenal, much better than the industrial, you know, mm-hmm. type of peppers. And people recognize this. And those peppers need to be maintained. And NMSU has done a lot of research on our native chilies because they want to patent some of the traits that are in our chilies. Phytophthora resistant, pest resistant, drought resistant, salinity resistant. I mean, these peppers have survived all of these circumstances, and this is why we have to protect them.
Your guys are pushing for an act. I hear you say you want legislation that would protect farmers who aren't using this.
Yeah, well, it was actually to protect any farmer from contamination of any genetic engineered crop. Alfalfa, cotton, and things like that. But, of course, Monsanto and the Mexico Chili Association and NMSU lobbied really hard against that bill. We almost got it passed the third year. It was a tie vote. And then we lost some points.
I want to just go back as we're on this thing about, you know, your growers and who's growing what to John, because you brought up something I wanted to go back to. You said your customers, just you've been around for six generations. They know you. So there's a trust there. So they're not necessarily worried that you're sneaking in peppers from Mexico or China.
I have not had any of my customers ever wonder about us sneaking stuff in they know us. I mean, it's a brand that's been around for a long time. Sickler Farms, they know not only us, but they know where we farm. We're
You guys are usually, are you selling locally? Do you ship out?
Yeah, well, both, mm-hmm. right? We're selling locally. We have a store, I think I mentioned a little bit mm-hmm. earlier, on San Mateo, a couple blocks south of Lomas, and we've been there. This is, I think, our 30th season. Mm-hmm. And we do ship out around the rest of the country. But, yeah, we... our customers just know who we are. Many of them know us personally or have come to know us over the years, not just with me, but my dad and my grandfather and his dad have been growing chili and fruits and vegetables and produce in the valley for a long time. So there is no concern from the people that come into – I mean, there's people that may not know us that come into our store, obviously, and want to know where the chili is from and where we grow it and how we grow it and, you know, why is – our chili, why is our chili better than Hatch chili, or is it better than Hatch
and
chili?
And why you don't have a sign that says Hatch chili.
And why we don't have a sign that says Hatch chili. Yeah, I mean, to the uninitiated, they're going to – it's this Hatch thing that has this mystique around it that is the best chili in the world. But as Dave pointed out a little bit earlier, chili is a fruit, and as you grow chilies in more temperate climates, they grow more slowly, and they have more time to actually – grow flavors into fruits. And so as you move up the valley, even in the middle Rio Grande Valley and up into northern New Mexico, the same it takes, you know, less time to grow the flavor into the chilies down south as you would up north, and you just grow in more flavor.
I just want to get one more caller in because she's been waiting a long time. He has been waiting a long time. Don in Albuquerque had a question about canning chilies.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Don, are you there?
Yes, I am.
What is your question, real quick?
All right. So for the past few years, I've always gotten some green chili, roasted it, peeled it, deseeded it, chopped it all up, and then I can it so I can send it to my daughters out of state.
Uh-huh.
And I was never really sure, could never find in the ball book or anything about the acid content. So I've been adding a little bit of vinegar and using a pressure canner. But I'm wondering if that's kind of overkill, if you could just do it with a water bath.
What do you think, Dave?
No, I think you're doing it the right way.
Mm-hmm.
Chili is a low-acid fruit, and you have to add some acid to it when you can it. Canning is not a very popular way to produce chilies at home, but it does work, and especially if you add some acid to it. So I think you're doing it exactly right.
So thank you very much, Don, for that question. I didn't know that people can chilies. I guess you can anything. We're almost out of time, but real quickly, folks, going forward, what do you think? Do we think we need to take action, or should we do something to make sure that we have traditional farmers like Sickler, like other people up in Chimayo, and we have these heritage crops?
Well, the little town or the little village of Chimayo has a certification mark for Chimayo chili. But if the state legislature says they can't use that and that's not applicable and they can't call themselves Chimayo chili, I think that I agree with you that that should not happen because for a long time there were other chili manufacturers who were putting out the bags of red chili pods that said Chimayo on them and they weren't from Chimayo.
Okay, well, unfortunately, that is all we have time for. I know there's much more we could talk about. Thank you to everyone who shared their love of chili and ideas for how we can ensure the future of this food and all the traditions that surround it. Thanks to my guests, Dave DeWitt, food historian, founder of the Fiery Foods and Barbecue Festival, John Sickler of Sickler Farms, Michelle Miller from the New Mexico Chili Association, and Isara Andaluz with Save New Mexico Seeds. You can continue the conversation on Twitter with KUNM News. You can also share your comments on the KUNM call-in show page at KUNM.org. We have more links and resources there as well if you want to delve into all things chili. Our engineer today was Marino Spencer. Kaveh Movahead answered your calls. Anna Landy Life tweeted the show. Sarah Trujillo assisted with production. Elaine Baumgartel is the executive producer. Next Thursday morning at 8 o'clock, tune in for KUNM's special election coverage, The Making of Clinton and Trump, Character in the 2016 Election from NPR News. The KUNM Call-In Show will be back on September 15th. Thanks, as always, for joining us and joining the conversation. I'm Megan Kamrick, and this is KUNM.